The 2021 Atlantic hurricane season is underway, and it's time to learn how to deal with these storms from the experts.
There's a force out there that's much greater than all of us, and I really wanted to understand it.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk about the science and history of predicting hurricanes. We'll also spend an academic minute with COVID-19 and drownings. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. June 1st was the beginning of the Atlantic hurricane season. Over the past few years, it seems there have been more and more powerful hurricanes hitting the United States, and scenes of massive damage from the storms have almost become commonplace in the summer and fall. So to learn more about hurricanes, we went to an expert. Dr. Athena Masson is a meteorologist and hurricane specialist at the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network at the University of Florida. I asked her why she decided to make hurricanes a big part of her life.
I feel like I was maybe smacked in the head during a young age going through Hurricane Andrew in the Miami Beach area. It was a Category 5 when it came ashore, and I remember just everything about it, even though I believe I was 3 years old, but I remember the winds. I remember just the damage. And at one point, the satellite dish from a TV station down the street from us came rolling down our street and smashed into the house at the end of the street. It was something I could not forget as a child, and even to this day, that there's a force out there that's much greater than all of us. And I really wanted to understand it and how we can protect ourselves. So the hurricane chose me.
Why does the Atlantic hurricane season get so much attention? I mean, they get storms in the Pacific, or don't they?
Yes, the Pacific does get storms. The Eastern Pacific, the Western Pacific, even out towards Hawaii and the Central Pacific. What generally happens in the Eastern Pacific, though, a lot of these hurricanes are forming off of Central America and down towards the northern parts of South America. And because of the trade winds, they are pulled from east to west all the way out to sea, and then they fizzle. It's very uncommon for hurricanes to impact California or sometimes the Baja region. They're usually weakening and going out to sea, so not a lot of attention to them. There's a lot of attention towards Japan, South Korea, China. Obviously, they get their share of hurricanes, but for the Atlantic, we're going back to that trade wind phenomena where we usually see them form off the west coast of Africa, travel across the Atlantic. And of course, what lies in sight, we have the Caribbean, we have the United States, we have Central America. So it's always on our minds because we're in a very vulnerable spot.
When did science start to try to predict hurricanes beyond, gee, it's getting windy and dark over there?
This goes back so many years. And if we were to pinpoint kind of where real weather forecasting began, it started in the 1840s. And it's all thanks to the invention of the electric telegraph. It made forecasting weather somewhat possible, but very basic. They knew that during severe weather seasons in the spring and the fall, they would notice that most of the storms over the United States would move in a west to east formation generally. So those in Denver, if they got hit by a storm, now they're telegraphing in to Kansas City, for example, and saying like, hey, we just got hit by something, be prepared. And this is generally when the first weather maps were starting to be created. Very basic idea, though. We're looking at low and high pressure systems moving from west to east. And we did not account for, are they gaining or losing strength? Maybe they're diverting a little bit to the northeast. No, it was very rigid. So obviously weather systems, they don't travel due eastward. And therefore you can imagine people make fun of us all the time saying that we are wrong all the time. No, in the 1840s, they were wrong constantly because not all the time did a system from Denver make it to Kansas City. But it was a start. But when it came to hurricanes, that was a little bit of a different ballgame, because over land, we have observers, weather stations that are collecting data, and you can kind of warn people in the next town over if something's coming. Hurricanes, completely different ballgame, though, because they are forming out in the middle of the ocean. And last time I checked, no one has little houses out there to warn us if something is coming. And so in the 1860s and 1873, that was the first official hurricane warning, or in this case, hurricane threat, that was issued to the United States. At the time, we didn't have the National Weather Service. We had what was called the U.S. Army Signal Corps. And on August 21st, 1873, they issued this quote-unquote hurricane warning from Cape May, New Jersey, to New London, Connecticut. So how did they kind of do this, though? You still didn't go out and issue a warning to the public like we do now over radio. Instead, they put signal flags or hurricane-like flags along the coastline. Well, again, we're still back in the 1870s. Stuff is wrong constantly. So the hurricane luckily missed, but ended up hitting Newfoundland, Canada, and killing at least 223 people, most of which were at sea. But at this point, things start to get better. We're learning stuff. Well, if we were to continue to stick in the 1890s, this is when technology, quote unquote, technology really started to flourish. And it all started with underwater cables to connect the Weather Bureau to a few Caribbean islands. So from Florida all the way out towards the Bahamas. This helped because now we can communicate with the Bahamas. So what happened in 1893, this was proven to taken to the test. Were these cables going to be sufficient? The Bahamas relayed to New York City, hey, something's forming to our north, and we think that it is going towards you. You need to be putting up a little bit of a heads up and getting your residents ready. A few days later, the hurricane made a direct hit at New York City. And then 2 days later, the Bahamas issued another warning saying, hey, there's another storm. You may want to watch the East Coast. Savannah, Georgia got impacted and all the way up towards South Carolina.
We've gone from that to now we have satellites and we're even flying planes into the middle of these things.
Oh, boy. Yeah, that's a nice and awesome, funny story about how the hurricane hunters got started. And we definitely need them because they give us such crucial indicators on the strength and direction that a storm is taking based on dropsondes that they produce. But if you can believe this, the whole idea of hurricane hunting started as a dare in the middle of World War II. And it was from Lieutenant Colonel Joe Duckworth, who at the time was stationed at an Air Force base just along the Gulf of Mexico coast. He took a single engine Texas training aircraft into the eye of the hurricane because at the time at breakfast that morning, some veteran British pilots who were on base trying to learn instruments for flight training, they started making jokes that American airplanes were being flown away from the path of this storm that was approaching Galveston and that therefore their aircrafts, American aircrafts, were not resilient enough or that they were weak. So Duckworth got annoyed with them, said, okay, I'm going to fly my airplane right into that hurricane. And he did it. He went directly into it. And as he was approaching it, tower control in Houston relayed to him, like, are you out of your mind? Do you know what's ahead of you? Okay, where are we going to be sending the rescue crews in order to locate your body and the wreckage? Well, Duckworth proved them all wrong. He went through the eye of the hurricane. He came back. And one of the main meteorologists at the base at the time was waiting for him and says, I want to go and research it myself. Later that day, they went back out and did it again. So that was how the Hurricane Hunters started, by a dare. But it was a perfect dare, because at that time they realized they need aircrafts to go into the hurricane in order to determine the structure of the hurricane, but also what are the true wind speeds of a hurricane. And that revolutionized all of hurricane forecasting at that time.
Have we reached the point where we can see one of these waves coming off Africa and you can say, yeah, that one looks like it's going to be trouble, whereas this one, nah, it's going to dissipate?
We all know Mother Nature will always deliver us a hand that we cannot win at the end of the day. There's so much still that we need to know about tropical cyclones and how to accurately forecast them. Satellite technology has helped us significantly, and that started back in the 1960s when the first satellites started to be put into orbit and monitor Earth's cloud cover and the first weather patterns. So it wasn't until around 1961 that we discovered and actually saw a clear image of our first hurricane. We've come a long way from that point, but now we're going back to the Hurricane Hunters. We still need the Hurricane Hunters to fly out into these hurricanes, because this is the way that we generally know the exact amount of wind speed, maximum wind speeds that are within a cyclone and where they are going. Because as that hurricane approaches shore, we have a better forecast with it. With those off of Africa, though, we have a little bit of a problem. Africa at this time does not have a Hurricane Hunter program that can ship off one of their hurricane hunters into the storms that are closer to them. We can't deploy our hurricane hunters all the way across the Atlantic towards Africa and then ask them to fly back. There's just not enough fuel within the jet in itself, and that's a very long track and dangerous trip. With hurricanes that are forming off of Africa, a lot of people don't know this. We use what's known as the Dvorak technique. And this was devised back in the 1960s, right when the Saffir-Simpson hurricane wind scale was coming about. The Dvorak technique estimates cyclone intensity based solely on visible and infrared satellite images. It's great in a way because, again, we cannot fly all the way to Africa and put drop zones into these hurricanes, but it's not an accurate representation of the true strength. We may be estimating wind speeds just based on the shape of a hurricane, when really it could be housing something either much stronger or maybe even a little bit less.
Still to come, our conversation with Dr. Athena Masson continues with a look at how the hurricane season has been changing in recent years. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is Dr. Athena Masson, a meteorologist and hurricane specialist at the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network at the University of Florida. We are talking about the beginning of the Atlantic hurricane season and how science is helping predict where these storms might go and how strong they might be. Earlier, Dr. Masson talked about Hurricane Andrew. That storm began with A, obviously the first storm of the season, and it hit the U.S. coast in late August. When Dr. Masson and I recorded our conversation, it was May 26th, and a tropical storm had already formed in the Atlantic. I asked if these storms are coming earlier and getting stronger.
Andrew was back in the very early 90s, and at the time, there was a strong El Nino that was in effect. So what happens during an El Nino year for the Atlantic, sea surface temperatures are very minimal and wind shear values begin to increase, both of which do not favor the development of hurricanes. Hurricanes like it very warm, very tropical. Sea surface temperatures need to be at least 80 degrees Fahrenheit and warmer, and minimal vertical wind shear in the atmosphere so that these thunderstorms can progress and grow into the higher layers of the atmosphere, create a low pressure center. With Andrew, that year was particularly cool in all of the Atlantic. So a lot of people became what I like to call hurricane amnesia, that they don't recognize that you're still vulnerable even if the hurricane season isn't starting until late August. That's significant. So a lot of people were caught off guard with Andrew, and plus it evolved and grew so rapidly. And we can get into this for hours, but there were a lot of forecasts that were wrong, saying that it would turn before it would hit the Florida coastline. But now let's go all the way to where we are now. 7 consecutive years, and it's including this year, that we have seen an early start to the hurricane season. Our hurricane season generally runs from June 1st all the way to November 30th, because during this time period, these are the prime conditions: warm sea surface temperatures, minimal vertical wind shear. You know the story. Prior to these months, we see cooler temperatures. We're coming out of winter, and it takes time for the ocean to warm up. Well, we just saw subtropical storm Ana form northeast of Bermuda just a few days ago. And sea surface temperatures are already prime for additional activity. We're looking at sea surface temperatures that are already over 80 degrees in parts of the Gulf of Mexico and in the Caribbean. So to give you a sense of what an average hurricane season is, it has changed, unfortunately, over the past year. So it is a little bit different for 2021 coming in. In 2020, we were still using the old 30-year statistical data set that hurricane forecasters use. During an average hurricane year, and this still included the year that Hurricane Andrew impacted, we would generally see in the Atlantic 12 named storms, 6 of which would become hurricanes, so wind speeds of at least 74 miles per hour, Category 1 to Category 5. 3 would be major hurricanes, Category 3 and higher. Now with 2021, we have a new 30-year data set that starts from 1991 and goes through 2020. We're now increasing our named storms by 2, so 14 named storms for an average hurricane year. 7 hurricanes, that's an addition of 1 from the previous set, and still 3 major hurricanes. Yes, we have seen a change and an increase in hurricane activity over the past 30 years. A lot of it can be related to the Atlantic Multidecadal Oscillation. It's an oscillation that occurs every 30 years, and it involves 2 cycles, a positive and a negative cycle. Positive cycle, which we have been in since 1995, shows an increase in sea surface temperatures, minimal vertical wind shear, and that allows for an increase in hurricane activity. This was seen back in the 50s and the 60s. We saw another spike in activity before we went then into a negative cycle for the 70s and 80s. Not a lot of hurricane activity when you're looking at the stats of those hurricanes during those years. 1995 comes along, we're back into this very active period. And we could be stuck in this period until the 1930s, or until the 2030s, excuse me. So this is just kind of an indicator that we still have a long ways to go if this oscillation is true. But I also want to point out, we know for a fact sea surface temperatures are rising. We do have climate change that is an issue. We are seeing a warming planet. So even if we follow this oscillation and we go back to a negative cycle in the 2030s at some point, are our sea surface temperatures already too warm that yes, we may technically be in a negative cycle, but we're just at a minimal positive cycle, that our sea surface temperatures just continue to stay at that threshold for hurricane activity?
Are storms getting stronger? Do we need Category 6?
I hope that we never get to that point of Category 6. The category scale was developed to assess damage, not necessarily to look at different components scientific-wise, because it was devised by Herbert Safir in the 1960s, who was commissioned by the United Nations to go down to the Gulf Coast states after Hurricane Camille and assess the damage. What type of wind speed damage could make a beam snap in half? So it's based still on the damage in that respect. However, when you get up to the major categories, Category 4 to Category 5, there's very little difference when it comes to the damage, because at that point, Cat 4, Cat 5, everything is devastation and demolished. So if we were to raise this to a Category 6, damage would still be the same, absolutely devastating. But if we were to look at scientific components, though, wind speeds, for example, could we possibly see a hurricane that could reach 200 miles per hour. I would really hate to think that, but we are seeing a bit of a trend, especially since 1995 when we entered into this positive cycle. We are seeing an increased amount of major hurricanes. And I know that the National Hurricane Center at first said that Eta and Iota were possibly Category 5 hurricanes when they came ashore last year in Central America. They've since downgraded it to Category 4s. But again, if we were to keep them at Category 5 strength, that would have been the fifth consecutive year that we have seen a Category 5 form in the Atlantic. Category 5s are rare, very, very rare. The last one before 2016 was back in 2007 with Felix. So we're seeing more Category 5s. Maybe it is time that we reamp the scale, reamp and maybe look at, do we truly need to shift some of the numbers and possibly even include maybe a Category 6? The reason why I hope that we don't really go to a Category 6, though, is that, again, it's going to be exceedingly rare, but the massive amount of concern and panic that that would spread across a population. Category 5 is already bad enough. Do we really need to add in a Category 6?
All right, look ahead. What's in the hopper technology-wise for better predicting the path and formation of these storms? And do you have a wish list for something?
My wish list is very long. Hopefully Santa will bring me something good underneath my Christmas tree this year. Our satellite technology is getting better and better every single year. We just put up a few of the GOES satellites, G-O-E-S, and they have been giving us such great detail with all weather phenomena. But I would also like in the future, and I believe that this is in the plans, to get a 3D look of what's happening inside of a hurricane. A lot of the time we just see a 2D view. We're just looking down at the earth and we're looking at the tops of the clouds. We don't know what's going on in between because there's a lot of stuff that goes on between the mid layers of the atmosphere compared to the lower, compared to the higher layers of the atmosphere. I really hope that we can get more 3D dimensional views of hurricanes, because even though we may see that the top of the storms are still pulsating outwards and growing, there might be some cooler air within the middle layers of the atmosphere that's choking off that hurricane. And maybe that can give us a sign of, oh, it's about to weaken, instead of just focusing on the top. My greatest wish list, though, and this was what my PhD dissertation was on, was that I hope that we can formulate a new scale, revise the Saffir-Simpson hurricane scale in a way, because it hurts me to see every single year that we are focusing on just the wind speeds of a hurricane and then categorizing it just based on that. Because we all know at this point, we've been through so many hurricane seasons, especially starting in 2016 with Matthew, that it's not the winds that are the main killer, the main threat. It's one of the threats, but it's not all of them. We need to bring back barometric pressure and especially storm surge, but we also need to be measuring another few components. In my scale that I wrote about, we should also be including the size of a system. A smaller hurricane is going to be more of a windstorm compared to that of a storm surge. And plus, a larger hurricane will impact a larger area and more people's property and lives are going to be at risk. We also need to look at the forward speed of a system. This goes back to Hurricane Harvey. Harvey, when it came ashore, it was moving as a Category 4 system. True that the shorelines got the majority of that storm surge damage and the wind damage, but as that hurricane stalled over the region, it's not going to be remembered for when it impacted land as a Category 4. It's going to be known as when it just sat over Houston as a tropical storm and rained itself out. And the forward speed had a lot to do with it. And finally, how much rainfall falls from a hurricane goes back to the forward speed. If it's sitting over an area, that rainfall is just going to create a massive flooding. We saw feet of rain, not inches of rain that we generally see in typical hurricanes. So my greatest wish list is that we really do have a scale sometime in the near future that we can relay to the public that these are the main threats with a hurricane and why you need to be prepared. The storm surge is going to be your greatest risk, not the winds. Or the winds may be a greater risk in these areas, but not necessarily these areas. at the end of the day, I can guarantee you, hurricane season, but when we start reporting on these hurricanes and saying a category 2 is heading towards Tampa, Florida, knock on wood, I hope this doesn't happen, but a category 2 heading towards Tampa, Florida, I'm going to be getting so many people saying, oh, it's only a category 2. That's nothing. When really it could be something if you were to look at other components.
Again, Dr. Athena Masson is a meteorologist and hurricane specialist at the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network at the University of Florida. You can check out her website at weathergoddess.com. One of the unexpected consequences of COVID-19 is an increase in drownings. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
As temperatures rise, water safety continues to be an important topic during COVID-19. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, William D. Ramos, associate professor in the Department of Health and Wellness Design at Indiana University Bloomington, explains why.
The World Health Organization recently proclaimed drowning to be a global burden and the third leading cause of unintentional death on the planet. Drowning is also a significant public health concern in the United States. After birth defects, drowning is the main cause of unintentional deaths for children ages 1 to 4. If we expand the age range to ages 1 to 14, drowning still remains the second leading cause of unintentional death behind motor vehicle crashes. Researchers in the water safety sector are watching to see if the coronavirus pandemic makes those statistics bleaker as Americans face the need to social distance last summer. We've already seen some evidence of a drowning spike. Last summer, both Florida and Lake Michigan shorelines experienced an increase in drowning rates, with the latter marking a grim 10-year high. This summer looks to be more promising in that more Americans are vaccinated and therefore more public swimming pools and beaches will be open. But the exponential growth in home pool sales has attracted the attention of water safety experts. This is a major concern because we know that 70% of drownings in the U.S. occur in home pools due to a variety of factors, including lack of supervision and ineffective barriers to prevent unauthorized access. In an effort to dampen any spike in drowning rates, aquatic safety experts will be working with nonprofit and government partners to ramp up existing water safety education programs, whether it be creating legislation around rules for owning and operating a home pool, or more effectively engaging with social media to reach audiences that might typically be addressed in person. And we will be studying how the associated behaviors leading up to drownings during the pandemic have changed, and then calibrate prevention efforts as appropriate.
That was William D. Ramos of Indiana University Bloomington. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.
Thank you.